Show on the Republic Broadcasting Network. I'm Scott Horton. My website is weekendinterviewshow.com. I keep all the archives there in MP3 format for you. My email address is scott@weekendinterviewshow.com or scott@antiwar.com. I'm an assistant editor there and also write for them. And I have a couple of things to talk about real quick before we get to our first interview today. First of all, a federal appeals court has refused to reinstate Sybelle Edmonds' lawsuit, and she is vowing to appeal to the Supreme Court. Also, I want to encourage everyone in the local listening area in Austin, Texas, if you're within the city limits, please go and vote today. It's not too late for you to go and vote no on the smoking ban. And it is also not too late for you to go and vote for the anti-toll road candidates, two of whose name I know right off the top of my head, and the third, Wes Benedict, who I know is a libertarian and will never compromise on the toll roads. Margo Clark, I believe, is kind of a Green Party, left-wing liberal type, who also opposes the toll roads. And Casey Walker, who I don't know very well, but is on the same list, and all of them have refused to take money from the toll road PACs and all that. So please go out, and if you're within the Austin city limits, please go vote for Walker, Clark, or Benedict to oppose getting a permanent tracking device implanted in your car. Okay, great. Also, there's a smoking ban, and if you believe in liberty, then maybe you want to vote against that, too. Also, real quickly, David Hackworth is dead. May he rest in peace. Hardcore American soldier died, murdered basically by his government 30 years after the fact. He died of bladder cancer from his exposure to Agent Blue, which is, I guess, a chemical cousin of Agent Orange. And many Vietnam veterans exposed to Agent Blue have been dying of bladder cancer. And that now includes David Hackworth, unfortunately. And also, real quickly, the casualties in Iraq are, on the American side are now up to 1,595 Americans dead, somewhere between 15,000 and almost 40,000 is the estimate of American soldiers wounded there, while the official number, I believe, is much lower, near 10,000. So anyway, now that I have that out of the way, there's one more big piece of news that broke. Yesterday, 88 congressmen wrote a letter to the President of the United States asking him to respond to what is already being referred to as the smoking gun memo, which was leaked to the Sunday Times of London, which published it last Sunday, May 1st. Here to discuss the new revelations is Ray McGovern. He's a retired CIA analyst of 27 years, the founder of Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity, and writes for TomPaine.com. His articles are also posted at antiwar.com. Welcome to the show, Mr. McGovern.
Thank you. Glad to be with you.
It's great to talk to you. Now, before we get to the smoking gun memo and the weapons of mass destruction, sir, I'm kind of curious in your background. I wonder if you can tell me, what was your first public dissent against American foreign policy?
Well, Scott, I hesitate to describe it that way. Professional intelligence officers don't dissent or assent. The whole coin of the realm in our day was to tell it like it is. And to make a long story short, right after 9/11, as we watched the Bush administration, playing 9/11 in a most cynical way, really playing on the trauma, the very real trauma we all suffered on that date, to prepare for what looked to us early on as an unprovoked war, then we thought that we needed to repair to our objective intelligence analysis cubicles, so to speak, and try to spread a little truth around, because the captivated press had been transformed into a cheerleader.
Hold it right there. We got Ray McGovern. He's at a Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity. Be right back.
Thank you.
my friends, welcome back to the Weekend Interview Show. I'm Scott, and I'm talking with Ray McGovern. He was an analyst at the Central Intelligence Agency for 27 years and is the founder of Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity. Now, I look at the headlines, and I see that 250 people have been killed in Iraq in various truck bombs in the last 8 days, and I wonder how it is that America got mired in this situation over in Mesopotamia. When I read your articles, Mr. McGovern, is it correct for me to understand that you believe the Bush administration deliberately lied this country into war in Iraq rather than just acted on bad intelligence, as the Congress and the Blue Ribbon Panel have concluded?
Yeah. Well, one has to acknowledge that the Blue Ribbon Panel was appointed by the President of the United States, and that its terms of reference were all laid down by him. So you can look at that as an independent panel if you wish, but if you're that kind of person.
Point taken.
Okay. And the Senate investigation of last year, the one that reported in July, that's headed by one of the most devoted White House followers, and that's Senator Pat Roberts of Kansas, who is always faithful to his marching orders from the White House. So what we have as a result of those two, quote, investigations, end quote, is really the president saying, the intelligence made me do it. The notion being bandied about in the press is that our poor president was misled by faulty intelligence to thinking there were weapons of mass destruction in Iraq where there were none, and so he launched an unnecessary war. Well, this smoking gun document proves is that the president had long before any intelligence came up, he had decided together with Tony Blair to launch a war against Iraq. The wording of this document shows that the head of the British CIA, they call it MI6, he returned from Washington, high-level meetings in Washington in mid-July of 2002. And what he said was basically, well, this is what he said, military action is now inevitable. Bush has decided to remove Saddam through military action. He's going to use the justification of terrorism and weapons of mass destruction. When people asked him, well, you know, what intelligence is that? Then the head of the British intelligence said, quote, the intelligence and facts are being fixed around the policy, end quote. Now, that's what we have been seeing for 3 years, we veteran intelligence professionals for sanity. There's copious evidence that this was the case, that the intelligence was adduced ex post facto the decision for war, and was just used primarily to confuse and deceive our Congress into voting for the war. Here we have it in black and white. Here we have it in a secret document out of the discussions among Prime Minister Blair and his very top advisors. And so no longer is it possible for people to say our poor president was misled by faulty intelligence. Was the intelligence bad? It was worse than bad. It was corrupted. How was it corrupted? It was corrupted because the director of Central Intelligence, George Tenet, decided that he would bend to the wishes of the White House and concoct the worst national intelligence estimate that has ever been concocted in our history.
Now, Mr. McGovern, this memo, the importance here, I mean, forgive me, but I think probably in a month or two before the war, if people learned about a memo like this, I'm sorry, I didn't phrase that right. If people learned about a memo like this that was written up in only a month or two before the war, it probably wouldn't matter all that much. But the importance here is the date, right? July 23rd, 2002. This is before Dick Cheney even went on Meet the Press and even brought up Iraq at all, right?
Yeah, it's before anything. Now, the decision for war, I believe, was very close after 9/11. That's when they saw that they could mislead the American people into thinking that Iraq had something to do with 9/11. And so that made it possible. And so they mounted that campaign, a very effective campaign, by the way. Most Americans still believe that Iraq had something to do with 9/11. Can you believe it?
Yeah.
Even though the administration has admitted now that it's not the case. So what they did after 9/11 was prepare the propaganda basis, but then they told the British that we're going to do this war, and as we see in this document, when the head of their intelligence conferred with George Tenet and other top advisors in Washington in mid-July 2002, he brought back word, the decision is inevitable. The president has decided to remove Saddam Hussein by military means, and the evidence that will be adduced has to do with terrorism and has to do with weapons of mass destruction, at which point the foreign minister, Jack Straw, said, well, you know, I agree the president has decided to take military action, but the case for it is very thin. And this is a direct quote. Saddam was not threatening his neighbors, and his weapons of mass destruction capability, so-called, was less than that of Libya, North Korea, or Iran. And so he was worried about how we're going to dredge up the kind of evidence that would persuade Parliament and also the Congress to vote for this war. Well, in the ensuing months, they very artfully dragged up these so-called weapons of mass destruction and other things like forgeries and aluminum tubes and 45-minute warnings and so forth.
Another thing that they brought up in that memo was, if I remember right, they say, well, there's Plan A and Plan B. Plan A is a massive buildup of forces and going through the UN Security Council and then having a war. Plan B is coming up with some sort of casus belli and starting the war right now with the troops that are already on the ground, 6,000 mm-hmm. or so in Saudi Arabia. And you wrote in your most recent article that you take it, the implication there is that we will create a casus belli if we have to.
Well, let me read you the words. Running start, that's the option B. Use forces already there in theater. Do a continuous air campaign, and it would all be initiated by, quote, an Iraqi casus belli, cause for war. Total lead time of 60 days with the air campaign, beginning even earlier, okay? Now, how are they going to orchestrate an Iraqi casus belli?
Particularly when Hussein was writing a romance novel and living his own life.
Well, actually, when he was beginning to cooperate fully with UN inspectors.
So, yeah, even more to the point.
So the implication there is very clear that if Saddam Hussein will not give us a reason to make believe this war is retaliation, we'll dredge one up. And the reason I mention this or called attention to it is simply the fact that were this to happen again vis-a-vis Iran, this precise option would be still on the books. And I ask Americans to be aware. Once you hear that Iran has fired on one of our planes, or Iran has tried to interdict one of our ships in the Persian Gulf, look at that as a possible provocation on our part, a casus belli, perhaps preliminary to an airstrike against the Iranian facilities.
You were in the CIA during the Gulf of Tonkin incident, weren't you?
I was.
Can you tell us that story quickly?
Yeah. There were two Gulf of Tonkin incidents, one on October 2 and the other on October 4 of 1964. The first one was real. The second one, nothing happened in the second one. It was all faulty radar and a very inexperienced radar man. We knew that evening, and yet the president seized upon that to initiate the air war against the North Vietnamese forces and to force through the Gulf of Tonkin resolution, which passed 98-2, and which was the justification for the Vietnam War for the next 10 years. Now, what's the difference between that and what our president today, George W. Bush, did in September and October of 2002 when he persuaded Congress to authorize war? The difference is this. Johnson was seizing a target of opportunity. Johnson was convinced that the communists were going to take over Southeast Asia. He was wrong, but at least it was a sincere belief on his part. He saw a danger to the United States. He thought we needed to win the Vietnam War. And, you know, I don't justify his tactics, but that was his motivation. In this case, the motivation was much less pure. There was no provocation from Iraq. Iraq was on its back militarily because of what we had done to it in 1991. Iraq posed no threat to anyone, not even to Israel. Why do we go into Iraq? Well, I use an acronym, OIL, for oil, for Israel, and for the logistical base that the neocons, so-called, think necessary to put into Iraq 14 permanent military bases so that we can dominate whatever happens in that region of the world, because it's important. Why? Because it has oil.
Well, and I really appreciate the way you say that. They believe that they must somehow secure it. But that's not necessarily true. I mean, frankly, if you live in a country that has a bunch of oil under the ground, you have to sell it or else it's worthless to you, you know?
Yeah. Scott, the big reality here, and it can't be emphasized enough, is that the world is running out of oil. And this, I believe, is the most important geopolitical fact of this century. The experts tell me that peak oil, that is the time at which production starts to decline and demand keeps zooming, that is maybe just a year or two away. Now, there's not going to be enough oil for everyone. There's going to be there'll be less and less available. The Chinese, the Indians are really increasing their demands in many ways. And so at some point, whoever's in control of Persian Gulf oil is going to have the high hand. And I think that's what the oil man Cheney was counting on as he looked toward the prospects of securing enough oil so that we could defend, quote, our American way of life.
Oil, Israel, and logistics. Ray McGovern. Hey everybody, welcome back to the Weekend Interview Show. I'm Scott. I love doing radio. How else am I going to get Ray McGovern on the phone, right? Radio, that's what it's all about. All right, so we're talking about oil, Israel, and logistics, what our president calls strategery. And apparently it was decided, well, and we know from Paul O'Neill, the former Secretary of Treasury, and from Richard Clark, the former head of counterterrorism, that it was decided before 9/11 that they were going to invade Iraq one way or another within the first term, and it was decided after 9/11 that they were going into Iraq as soon as possible. And so apparently the smoking gun evidence is now in the hands of our guest, the former CIA analyst of 27 years and founder of Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity. And this smoking gun memo from July of 2002, before Cheney even started making threats on Meet the Press, they had already decided that America and Britain were going to invade Iraq and that they were going to have to fix the intelligence around the policy, according to the exact words of that memo. And go ahead.
Yeah, no, Scott, I just wanted to say it was like beyond our wildest dreams that we would ever see that in black and white. We had been saying that this was what was happening for 3 years, and when we saw this secret document out of Britain, and we saw what it said, namely intelligence and facts are being fixed around the policy, well, we just found it hard to believe that anyone would put that down on a piece of paper, but they did. Now, this was to be very closely held. It was not to be shared with the likes of us, but there it is, hanging out there. And again, this person, the head of the British intelligence, is reporting back after extensive consultations with his opposite number, CIA Director George Tenet, and the people at the National Security Council. So he had the word directly from Washington, and this is what he was passing along. Let me say another thing, Scott, just before we get off this OIL business, oil, Israel, and logistics.
Mm-hmm.
This is not all that much of a departure from U.S. policy toward the Middle East for four decades.
Sure.
What I mean by that is that our policy was always aimed at achieving two objectives. One, securing the constant and assured provision of natural resources, read oil and gas, from the Middle East. And number two, safeguarding the existence of Israel within internationally recognized and secure borders. So in that sense, our policy had a great continuity. The difference between George W. Bush's administration and all that preceded was simply that they decided that it was okay to start an unprovoked war to achieve those aims. Now, that's a biggie in my view.
Right, that's what I was about to say. Was that, you know, all this is very important, you know, securing, got to make sure the Russians don't control it, right, or something.
Yeah,
but unfortunately, under the rule of law in the Western world, that's not a good enough reason to invade a country, is it?
Well, when you say rule of law, no, it certainly isn't. But you see, the rule of law doesn't apply when you're the, quote, sole remaining superpower in the world. And when Richard Perle, the archdean of the neocons, and who really is the intellectual author behind this new policy, when he was asked just shortly after the war began, well, this really is a violation of international law, is it not? And you know what he said? He said, sometimes you have to violate international law in order to do the right thing. So there it is, hanging out there. How about oil? Well, Wolfowitz, the deputy, until just recently, deputy secretary of defense, in that heady atmosphere right after the president had landed on the carrier and said, you know, mission accomplished and all that, he was asked, you know, why Iraq rather than North Korea? And you know what he said? He said, simple, Iraq swims on a sea of oil.
And this is the same guy who told Vanity Fair that, we basically settled on weapons of mass destruction for bureaucratic reasons, because it was the one idea that everybody could agree about.
That's exactly right. So you don't have to be a very astute analyst to put this all together and to say, well, this is what it was all about. Now, let's take a couple of steps backward here. As early as 1948, George Kennan, the icon of foreign policy for many of us, also said, look, the United States has about 8% of the world's population, controls about 40% of the world's wealth to live as high as we do, and so we really have to dismiss any altruism and any thoughts of human rights or liberties except our own, and we've got to build up the power so that we can keep hold of this 40% of the world's resources. That from George Kennan. That really is at the very basis of our policy. We had George Herbert Walker Bush telling us during the first Gulf War we were defending the American way of life. Well, the American way of life presumes that we will control a disproportionately large segment of the world's resources. And so, you know, there are people who come up to me after I make a lecture and they say, well, what is your problem, Mr. McGovern? You don't dispute the fact that we need the oil, do you? And, 1,600 American GIs, that's really not a very big price to pay for this, is it? Because we lost 58,000 in Vietnam. You don't dispute that we need the oil, do you? And I say to them, this is a profound moral question. This transcends Machiavelli or Realpolitik. This is a decision that we as Americans have to face up to. Do we have a right? Do we have a right to go and seize the oil of other nations or to seize
Simple.
Control?
The answer is absolutely not. All right, we'll be right back. It's Ray McGovern on the Weekend Interview Show. All right, everybody, welcome back to the Weekend Interview Show. I'm Scott, and I'm talking with Ray McGovern. He's a retired CIA analyst of 27 years and the founder of Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity. You can find what he writes at tompaine.com and at antiwar.com. And, sir, right before the break, you asked the question of whether it's worth it or not to sacrifice all these lives and have all this violence in order to secure that oil that everybody knows that we need. And I would just answer that question you asked, is it okay if America accepts what are supposedly our most basic principles that we claim to be exporting, and that is individual liberty and property rights, well, then we would have to answer that question in the negative. Stealing is wrong, right? Holding a gun to somebody's head and taking their stuff?
Yeah.
Christians, Jews, and Muslims agree about that, right?
I would hope, Scott. Maybe it'd be worth my telling you what I answered that fellow when he said, you know, we do need the oil. You don't dispute that. I looked at him, and he was very well dressed, you know, and I figured, well, maybe I'll try the utilitarian answer to him first. And I said, my problem with that is that we're not going to be able to do it, you know. We're just not going to be able to do it. I don't care if we are the sole remaining superpower in the world. There are 1.3 billion Muslims out there. There are porous borders all around Iraq. They're not going to let us do it, okay? That's the utilitarian argument. I am convinced of that. Anybody who's been through Vietnam knows that. That's the truth, okay? Now, he wasn't persuaded by that, so I looked at him and I said, well, okay, well, suppose your son was one of those 1,500 that were killed. You know what? He looked at me like the thought had never occurred to him. Because you know why? Because his son never would be among those. His son would not have to go into the army because his son is probably headed to college and in a good job. But that didn't convince him either. And so finally I said to him along the lines of what you just mentioned, Scott, I said, well, are you one of those that favor putting the Ten Commandments in the courthouses and the schoolrooms of this nation? And he said, well, yeah, that's a good idea. And I said, well, you know, I think there's, if I remember correctly, there's one that says, thou shalt not steal. Another that says, thou shalt not covet thy neighbor's goods. There's one that says you shouldn't kill. And there's another one that says you shouldn't lie. Maybe we ought to trim them down to six and then put six in the courthouses so they would not look down as hypocrites. Well, he turned on his heel and went back to his SUV and drove home. But the point is that they're immoral, they're utilitarian, there are human factors at work here, any one of which is enough to persuade me that we have to give up our original aims, O-I-L. And when we do that, then we can make a graceful or reasonably graceful exit from Iraq.
Hear, hear. And, you know, this, you're a very rational guy, former CIA analyst, but you're not really dealing with reason. You're dealing with neoconservatives and their ideology. And it occurs to me that, and, you know, this is something that I really have a lot of trouble with, and I have trouble, you know, understanding where the different splits are. But I know that apparently a month after this memo was written up, and Cheney went on Meet the Press and started threatening Iraq and talking about their nuclear weapons program and who knows whatever else, that James Baker, Brent Scowcroft, George Bush Sr. himself in a speech at Tufts University, and Lawrence Eagleburger, and a lot of these kind of old school, perhaps Yankee, perhaps cowboy type Republicans, seem to be chastising Jr. and telling him not to do this, that he was going about this the wrong way. I guess, you know, their lead voice inside the administration was Colin Powell in the first term. And I wonder, do you really think that Bush Sr. was against the Iraq War? That did he tell Scowcroft and those guys to come out and oppose Bush in that public way?
Well, I have no inside information here, but I am convinced, knowing these players, that they would not have done it without telling first President Bush first. They had been through these decisions. They knew what would happen. And if the young President Bush had the presence of mind just to read his father's book, he would have seen what his father had predicted, which is exactly what has now happened. You know, the core of this, Scott, has to do with the people who are advising Bush. Now, those folks, you know, the Richard Perles, Doug Feith, the whole slew of so-called neocons that permeate the Pentagon, the Vice President's office, and to a degree the State Department, they were around during the first President Bush's tenure. I was briefing the vice president at the time. These folks were universally referred to as, quote, the crazies, end quote. I kid you not. You'd come in to work on Monday morning and somebody would say, guess what the crazies did last Friday? You would know exactly who the reference was to. It would be, you know, Pearl, Feith, Wormser, Scott Libby, and all those folks. How was it that they made no real damage then? Well, because of Scowcroft, the National Security Advisor to President Bush the First, because of Jim Baker, his Secretary of State, they persuaded the first President Bush to keep these crazies at arm's length, keep them in middle-level positions where they couldn't do any harm, and he successfully did that. Now, when we watched in the year 2000, 2001, when we watched these same crazies come back in the positions of total power over our policy toward the Near East, we were aghast. We couldn't believe it. You know, the crazies were back, and this time they're running the show. And that's what we have here. We have people with an ideological kind of a strategic vision that gives us the sole right as the sole remaining superpower of the world to seize whatever the world's possessions or resources we think we need. And why should we do that? Well, because we can do it, and we would be remiss if we didn't do it. It shouts out of their documents, which anyone can download from Project for a New American Century. Just look them up. They're not hard to read. They're very, very illuminating in terms of throwing light on exactly what the vision, what the strategic vision and ideology are that are driving these folks.
Let's see if we can get into some of the specifics about the individual lies. I know we probably won't be able to get through it all, but I have a list here.
How much time do we have?
I have a partial list of weapons of mass destruction lies that were thrown at us and at our representatives in the Congress in the run-up to war, and that includes the aluminum tubes, the mobile laboratories, the Niger forgeries, the student's thesis paper, the supposed warehouses full of sarin, VX, and anthrax, the remote control planes that can fly across Israel, the Mediterranean Sea, the Atlantic Ocean to spray people on the East Coast with chemical weapons.
Right.
And maybe I'm leaving a few things out, but would you like to maybe just start with the aluminum tubes now? Oh, you know what? Before we get into that, or maybe as a preface to that, it's my understanding that Doug Feith and the guys in the policy department at the Pentagon created the Office of Special Plans to come up with a lot of the propaganda, the talking points to get us into the war. And it's my understanding that they did so because the CIA wasn't really lying well enough. And yet, to read your articles, it seems like George Tenet was really on board. So I wonder, first of all, why is it that you think that they felt they needed to create the Office of Special Plans? And then, secondly, relating to the aluminum tubes, was that not a CIA story as opposed to a Pentagon story?
Mm-hmm. Well, let's take the first. The so-called link between 9/11 and Iraq. This was something that Rumsfeld and Wolfowitz tried to make, this link, on 9/12. It was uppermost in their minds. James Woolsey, one of their neocon colleagues, went on TV and said it doesn't matter if Iraq were involved, they were going to go after them anyway because they harbor terrorists, so-called. So we have this very decided effort to associate Iraq with 9/11 right off the bat. Now, the CIA wouldn't cooperate, to their credit. And Tenet supported them in the early stages here, and you'll see if you go back to my writings in 2002, I was applauding Tenet for hanging in there. And it wasn't until Colin Powell's speech on the 5th of February 2003 that Tenet caved in. You'll recall him sitting behind Powell like a potted plant, just sitting there.
He fell asleep during it, I think.
Well, he nodded. It looked like he was trying to nod assent so that Colin Powell could claim the intelligence community was behind that. But up until then, they had resisted the notion that the Iraqis had anything to do with 9/11. And that is why the OSP, the so-called Office of Special Plans, was set up. If you can't get the right answer intelligence-wise from the bureaucracy, it's a hallowed tradition that policymakers will set up a rump group offline so that they can have some little group that they can claim they got the, quote, correct, end quote, answers from. And that's what these folks did, out of whole cloth, out of Jalabi's, the Iraqi National Congress fellow who was such a favorite of the Pentagon. This is bizarre. The Pentagon paid Jalabi to tell us lies, which they in turn passed up to the Vice President, President of the United States, lies that talked about things like biological weapons trailers. Let me just say a word about that, because I think that's the worst example. There was one source who was actually introduced to us by Jalabi, he was just one source that had all this information about these mobile weapons trailers. Germans who had him first, they had great doubts about his reliability, and turned out he was an alcoholic. It turned out that he wasn't who he says he was. Now, we knew all that, and the only American that debriefed this curveball source found out that Colin Powell, on the 5th of February, was going to say in his speech all this business about these mobile weapons, biological weapons factories. He was going to show artist renderings of it, and he was aghast. And so he told his boss, hey, this guy's a lush. He doesn't know what he's talking about. And here's the answer he got back from his boss. How do we know? We know because of his email. I'll read it to you. Let's keep in mind the fact that this war is going to happen regardless of what Curveball said or didn't say, and the powers that be probably aren't terribly interested in whether Curveball knows what he's talking about, end quote. Now, that's the kind of corruption. You get that down to the branch chief and division chief level of an intelligence analytical unit, and you've got complete corruption. And so Colin Powell was not told that this guy was speaking to his hat. And the last thing I'll say on this is simply, how did they think, it's a legitimate question, how did they think they could get away with this stuff? Well, I think their thought process went like this. We're going to adduce all this evidence, trick Congress into approving this war. They will approve it. We'll win handily. The people will meet us with cut flowers and open arms. We will have deposed their ruthless dictator. We've pretty much influence over the oil, and we will have eliminated any threat to the state of Israel. Now tell me, and when we've done all that, who's going to be so picayune? Who's going to come at that point and say, yeah, but you did it on the basis of forgeries and misreadings and fabrications. Who's going to say that when we're riding high? Now, that just shows to go that goes to show that there's no such thing as a perfect crime. They were dead wrong about the flowers and about
the
but
they were right that the American people don't really care that they were lied into the war. I mean, they got that part right, even though the war has been an absolute disaster by any measure. The people still don't care.
Well, Scott, you're right about that, and that's a really a lamentable development. But I think that just as in Vietnam, as the body bags still come home, and we're almost up to 1,600 now, and as the people become educated, and I hope that some mainstream press will pick up this document that was released to the London Times, as people become educated to the fact that, hey, this is all a gross deception. Politicization is sort of a mild term to describe what happened. This was out and out mass deceit and the cost in lives. You know, we talk about 1,600. On the Iraqi side, Iraqi civilians, the best estimates are 100,000 Iraqi civilians would be alive today had there not been this war unleashed.
That's from the Lancet Medical Journal in Great Britain.
And also Johns Hopkins, which cooperated in that study.
I need you, sir, to address the aluminum tubes a bit for me, if you could.
Yeah.
Now, I remember, not specifically my source and all that, but I remember long, long before the administration stopped talking about the aluminum tubes, the articles had already been written that pretty much debunked the use of these tubes for anything other than regular low-level artillery rockets. Am I right?
Well, it's not exactly that way, Scott. As I recall it, they seized a couple of these tubes, so they had, sort of something in hand. And as soon as Condoleezza Rice learned about it, she went on Sunday TV talk show, and she said, these aluminum tubes can only be used to make nuclear weapons. Now, that's what she said. And she said that even though the experts here, the Department of Energy experts down at Oak Ridge and elsewhere, knew those tubes would not be appropriate for making nuclear weapons. Then there was a big Donnybrook in the intelligence community, and one fellow in the CIA who was hell-bent and determined to prove that these could be used for nuclear weapons actually falsified laboratory test results. And how do I know that? It's in the Senate Intelligence Committee report of July of last year. He falsified the results to prove his case. And when the estimate was put out, there was a false consensus reported that most analysts, quote-unquote, believe that the tubes were for nuclear weapons. Some do not. Well, the experts, none of the experts believed that they were for nuclear weapons. And, of course, we know now that the specifications are exactly those that were used for artillery rockets. So,
well, not only that, but that they couldn't, that to alter them, to make them capable of being used for centrifuges for uranium enrichment would be absolutely incredible.
That's what
kind of modification.
Right, yeah. But, of course, Condoleezza Rice was on record as saying they could only be used in a nuclear application. And so the intelligence, again, was corrupted. Intelligence followed the policy, just as we're seeing here in this document, which says intelligence and facts are being fixed around the policy. Well, the estimate that was prepared in September and issued on October 1 of 2002 was corrupted, was not too hard to say it was prostituted to make sure that it agreed with the U.S. policy. And to see this in black and white in this document of reporting on the meeting of 23 July 2002, where the British is saying, yeah, Bush has decided on war, and yeah, we'll have to fall in here, and yeah, there's no evidence, but we'll make sure that we fix intelligence and facts around the policy.
And yeah, we know it's illegal, but...
Yeah, that too, you know. Even after, in this session, you know, you read the minutes, and this is the official document. We have the text of the document. Even after so-called Lord Goldsmith, I love the lords and the sirs, even after he told the whole group, including the prime minister, that regime change could never be the basis, never be a legal basis for launching a war against another country. Even after he had said that, Blair says, quote, well, now, if the political context were right, people would support regime change, right? Hello,
right.
Prime Minister. I just told you it's not a legal basis. Well, that was the idea. Regime change, whether it was legal or not, as you know, they got Lord Goldsmith to change his mind after a phalanx of National Security Council, American types, lawyers got at him, and 2 days before the war, he changed his mind and said, well, I suppose it could be legal. Well, you know, that's the impetus for the legal opinion, by the way, came from the chief of staff of the British Armed Forces.
Got to hold it right there, going out to the last break here. It's Ray McGovern on the Weekend Interview Show.
Back peeking in my window.
All right, everybody, welcome back to the Weekend Interview Show. Wrapping up here with Ray McGovern. He's a retired CIA analyst of 27 years and the founder of Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity. You can find his writings at tompaine.com, and many of them are also reposted at antiwar.com. And in fact, the top headline on antiwar.com right now, my friends, is Memo, Bush Made Intel Fit Iraq Policy. And that is a link to a story that refers to this original Sunday Times of London story from May 1st about a memo from July 23rd, 2002, about how, yep, we're going to invade Iraq and we're making up whatever lies we need to in order to justify it. Now, Mr. McGovern, I'm sorry, because I got five more questions for you in 5 minutes, and there's no way we can do it. But I think if I'm going to have to narrow it down and cross them off the list, I need to ask you about what Chalmers Johnson calls the developing Paris, Berlin, Moscow, Beijing axis against the United States. Are we pushing all of our major rivals together?
Well, I'm afraid we are, and it just makes eminent good sense for them. If there's one preeminent superpower in the world that reserves for itself the right to interfere in this or that country, or as the defense guidance now says, interfere against any country that is behaving irresponsibly, that's those are the words, then certainly they would find some strength in numbers. And the biggest factor here is that China and Russia are going to be conducting joint military exercises this summer, and this is something that would have been unheard of a brief decade ago.
Well, and we also know that Europe is going to begin selling weapons to China again next year.
Well, yeah, the U.S. is trying to prevent that, but that's what they'd like to do.
And also, I guess since we do have them in, I want to ask you about the gangs all here, your experience with these. Basically, the Iran-Contra crew is back in power, and, you know, with this 9/11 intelligence recommendations panel bill, whatever they call it, that they passed, they created this new office of the National Intelligence Director's Office.
Mm-hmm.
And I have no idea what death squads you're talking about, Negroponte, in charge of it.
Mm-hmm.
And that was, you know, whatever thoughts. You can ask yourself whatever question on that topic you like, I guess.
Well, you know, there are many things could be said here. What bothers me most is torture. Now, you know, torture, in my view, is just like slavery or like rape. It's never, never permitted. Not only is it not effective from a utilitarian point of view, but it's downright immoral. Now, our country has reserved the right to torture. It's legal. The president has issued a finding saying it's okay, and he's also defended the practice of rendering so-called captives to nations that do torture. The head of CIA, Porter Gossett, said, you know, we can't do much once we give these people to out of our control. Well, why do they put them out of our control? So they can be tortured. So here's Negroponte, the fellow who lied about Iran-Contra, the fellow who misled our Congress into thinking that the Hondurans, where he was ambassador, were observing civil liberties, whereas they were running death squads. He's going to be in charge of the folks that are permitted under the president's finding to do torture. Give me a break. It couldn't be much worse, because Negroponte will be doing what he always does. He's a functionary. He'll be obeying the president's instructions.
All right, well, good luck to everybody out there that gets to hold on to all your fingernails. The gun's all here.
Yeah, it's the civil liberties parts of this legislation are the most troubling to me. You know, people keep saying, well, you know, it's terrible to have the CIA and the FBI not sharing information, not cooperating. Well, they forget that there's very good reason why the CIA is separated from this. And just look to the abuses of the 50s and 60s in Vietnam.
All
right. And
all right, sorry, Mr. McGovern, we're all out of time. Coming up next, Gordon Prather. We'll be right back.
Mm-hmm.